This is the Education Gadfly Show.
In some ways, we're kind of like the Chilean gold miners.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is Mike Petrilli of the Thomas P. Fordham Institute here in the Education Gadfly Show online at edexcellence.net. Please join me welcoming my host straight from a Chilean gold mine, Janie Skull.
I wish I came, well, not from the gold mine itself, but I wish I had been there. It was quite a spectacle last week. Pretty amazing.
Hold on. Janie, you almost said you wish you had been in that mine.
I corrected myself. I wish I had been at the mine, not in the mine.
I mean,
it was pretty neat to watch, I have to say. You know, rarely do you actually get something so positive, on the news these days.
Yeah, this is true. This makes the whole world smile.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it. And that's what we try to do here on this show, too, is we try to give people a little something to smile about, as well as get angry about education policy. So in some ways, we're kind of like the Chilean gold miners.
In some ways.
All right.
You could say that.
All right. Well, let's see what kind of little pieces of gold we have here today. Lots to cover. We're going to start by playing Pardon the Gadfly. Then we've got our research minute. And, of course, Rate That Reform. So, Chris, let's start with Pardon the Gadfly.
All right, first question. Fordham's new report, Now What?, discusses what should happen next now that 3/4 of states have adopted the Common Core standards in English and math. Janie, Mike, Now What?
Now what, Mike?
Now what? Now what, huh? Now what, Chris? Here's what. You want to know what? Let me tell you what's what. So this paper is about basically, all right, we know that everybody knows that these standards that came out this summer, which we think are quite good, aren't going to implement themselves. Right, that to date, all they are some nice words on a website somewhere. That doesn't mean that right away teachers are actually looking at them, implementing them in the classroom, teaching to them, holding students to these higher expectations. For all of that to happen, lots of things need to go on. First of all, we need to develop tests, and that piece is getting developed. But we also need to train teachers, and we need to have licensure discussions about what teachers need to do to get prepared. We need to have online learning materials, new textbooks, curriculum, on and on and on and on. And so what we try to do in this new paper is say, hey, who should be doing all these things? The conventional wisdom is probably that basically this should all be left to the states at this point and to local school districts and to the marketplace, textbook publishers and like. But we raise the question, is that necessarily the right way to go, or should we think about having some of these things be done at a national level in an interstate way, the same way that the standards were completed?
And what I think is interesting about it is that you say, you know, the conventional wisdom, but actually the report, you know, commissioned a number of or it passed out a bunch of questions to a number of education experts and asked them to comment on them. And I thought it was really interesting how much they all varied. It seemed like there was basically very little consensus, you know, on the details overall. You know, we came up with a couple, you know, the three models that we came up with. But overall, the details were really varied. I think it's interesting that there really is no concrete vision for where this is supposed to go.
No, that's right. There's no agreement right now, and there's not been a lot of conversation. People just say, hey, we need there to be good implementation, but not a lot of conversation about who should do what. We lay out three models. Let's become more like France is the first one that would basically have a national school board take over. The second one is don't rock the boat, which is basically, hey, we've done the standards, we're doing the tests, otherwise just leave the status quo in place, let the states and districts handle this. And third is one foot in front of the other, this idea that we endorse of having some kind of coordinating council at the national level made up of governors and state education chiefs and some other folks to try to coordinate implementation over the next several years. Okay, topic number two.
All right, well, if you're a frequent listener to the podcast, you're probably sick of Mike talking about Michelle Rhee. So
what?
Not that we talk about her much, if not at all, on
now what,
this
Chris?
Show.
Now but what?
Now what? Let's talk about Randy Weingarten. Is she an evil genius? A well-meaning reformer? Or even both at the same time?
Right. So, you know, everybody knows that from Waiting for Superman that she's portrayed as some sort of Darth Vader character.
I mean, I have to say, it's pretty remarkable when you watch it. You don't expect her to be so, I mean, it looks like she's, you know, completely on the stump. She is just going back and forth across the stage, just so, you know, verbose, and it's kind of interesting to see.
Yeah, but yeah, she's angry.
Yeah, she's yeah, more up. So than I expected to. You know, you read her op-eds and you see her in the paper a lot, but I had never actually seen her acting like that, and it was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
At the same time, I don't know if I would say she's an evil genius.
Right. So the New York Times has this puff piece out on her recently by Tripp Gabriel. It basically says, hey, she's a reformer too, and she wants people to know it, and goes through that background on her behalf. And then she has a piece in the Washington Post this weekend basically rebutting a big manifesto by urban superintendents saying, hey, let's not scapegoat teachers. Look, here's the thing about Randy. I mean, she's very smart, she's very polished, and I think that she does have, you know, some good intentions. I think think she's not lying when she says that she supports things like treating teachers more professionally and some forms of differential pay. But look, you got to look at her actions instead of her words. And so at the same time she's saying, hey, we're in favor of all these reforms, she is spending $1 million to defeat Adrian Fenty in D.C. And why was that? It was because he pushed through a bunch of teacher reforms that are exactly aligned with the kinds of things that she says on paper she agrees with.
But I think there's two important things to keep in mind, which is one, that she's just doing her job, you know? That's why she's in her position, because she's good at her job. And no one's trying to pretend that unions' best interests are the actual students. It is the teachers. So, you know, even though I can't really support what she's doing, it's her job.
And so then, her job is to lie. Is that what you're saying?
No, not to lie. But
to be a hypocrite?
No. But, you know, I think it's remarkable that she actually is saying that she supports reform, whether or not she's actually kind of backing
telling
it up, which obviously is important. I'm not saying it's not. I'm not saying she's like some great reformer, but it is important, I think, that she's at least getting out there and making these claims and, you know, actually might be turning some people's minds in her own constituency. You never know.
All right, good. All right, topic number three. Oh, by the way, do you guys know that truthiness is now officially a word?
Officially?
Officially, yeah. It has made it into the language. So, speaking of Randy Weingarten. Okay, topic number three.
Well, speaking of Randy Weingarten, a lot of hoopla was made following her endorsement of the new Baltimore teachers' contract. Unfortunately, as it turns out, the Baltimore teachers voted it down. What's up with that?
What's up with that?
What's up with that?
Nice, Chris. Nice. You know, not only did she endorse it, but Arne Duncan endorsed it the day before they voted it down as a great sign of labor-management collaboration. So, which is true. I mean, both management and labor, you know, signed off on that. It just so happened that neither one of them could get the teachers on board. Janie, yeah. Where does it go from here?
I mean, I don't know. I just think, like we did when we looked at America's Best and Worst Cities for School Reform, it's a whole environment that goes into making actual reform. So yes, you have an administration that, you know, is pretty forward-looking, and definitely Andre Alonso is up there and he's trying to make a lot of change, and that's great.
And it sounds like the union is
working. Yeah, exactly. And the union actually seems like it's working with him. But at the same time, it's really, really difficult to actually implement reform. And I think people need to remember that. And that, you know, it's not just you come to an agreement and then everyone suddenly agrees and everyone gets on board. It takes a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And so I think what they're doing, where they're trying to go back and not make too many changes, but just kind of clear up a lot of the confusion and really just try to talk to people and explain what's going on, I think that's probably a good step.
It's interesting. In D.C., you in some ways had the parents voting against reform. And now in Baltimore, you have teachers voting against reform. And you know, reformers will respond by saying, well, we just need better communication campaign. Maybe, but maybe we also need to acknowledge that, you know, these kinds of changes are very unsettling, and mm-hmm. we need to find a way to give, as they say, give voice to these constituents, and, you know, that they've got some legitimate beefs. We have to take them seriously. Okay, that's it for Pardon the Gadfly. Well played, Janie. Now it's time for everyone's favorite segment, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here, as always.
I understand that we have a special treat for us this week, that it's a study about our county, Montgomery County, Maryland.
Yes, our county, so it's a little bit longer. Don't be dinging me, but this
it's
a hometown story. Might be the 90-second range.
All right. Hey. As a hometown guy here from Tacoma Park, Maryland, I say go for your 90 seconds.
All right. So it's a new study out by the Century Foundation. It examines the impact of economically integrative housing policies on student achievement in Montgomery County, right here in our own backyard. So a little bit of background first, and then I'll get right to the findings. So basically, we mostly assume that having poor children attend wealthier schools helps them do better. I mean, it's a reasonable argument, but it's been really tough to study because we can't separate the effect of the school from the effect of having a motivated parent choose a school. But this study actually addresses that problem. So since the 1970s, Montgomery County's had a unique zoning policy that allows real estate developers to set aside a portion of the homes they build to be rented or sold at below market prices.
Not allows, it requires them.
Yes, requires. Yes. And then the public, the allowing part is the public housing authority can purchase up to a third of those homes. So anyway, so applicants are randomly assigned to public housing apartments, which prevents they're self-selecting into a neighborhood of their choice. So basically, it has the effect of scattering these low-income families into higher-income neighborhoods that are obviously zoned to wealthier schools. So research has examined the performance of roughly 850 students in public housing from 01 to 07 who attended elementary schools and lived lived in neighborhoods that fell along a spectrum of very low poverty to moderate poverty, which is important. There are no high poverty since we're talking about Montgomery County and it doesn't really have any of those. So over multiple years, children in public housing who attended the district's most advantaged schools, so now this is a lot of detail, but those are the schools that were defined as having less than 20% of students in free and reduced lunch status, significantly outperformed in math and somewhat outperformed in reading compared to those children in public housing who attended the district's least advantaged schools. And then by the other big finding by the end of elementary school, the achievement gap between children in public housing and the most advantaged schools and their non-poor peers was cut by half for math and one-third for reading. So kind of closed up the gap. So, you know, it's important to remember this is Montgomery County. You know, it's really hard to do this in districts that are really densely poor. But Montgomery County is kind of neat because it's pretty diverse already. So you already had some poor kids who were, you know, mixed in with a lot of wealthier and middle class citizens. So a really neat study that probably can never be replicated.
I guess my first question is, because you said they eliminated the whole problem with, you know, having parents who self-select and, you know, are very interested. I mean, the people who apply to this project, though, I would think are already people want to get into these.
That's right. So, I mean, if you're in terms of the limitations of the study, you got to think about, okay, we can apply these findings to parents who are interested in these types of programs.
Yeah. Okay. So it's less limited than others. Right.
But it can be replicated. I mean, if other places were willing to have these kinds of housing policies.
Right.
I mean, this is.
But not in Baltimore, not in D.C.
All right. But in the suburbs, metropolitan areas, we have, you know, the suburbs and especially the inner suburbs are where we still see a lot of diversity, racial, economic, you know, and so Montgomery County is not that atypical. What's atypical is that because it's a border state or, you know, with other ones in the south, it's a countywide school system.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so you've got some more possibilities there than you do in a lot of other places, at least to do this on a countywide system. But, you know, you could have other suburbs of all of our major metro areas could, if they wanted to have these kinds of housing policies. Now, it also is unique in that Montgomery County is fairly liberal, and so they were able to pass these housing policies and say, hey, yes, we want to have poor people living within our wealthy communities. That has not always been a great thing to sell in much of America.
Well, what was interesting, too, is Montgomery County's done this green red zone kind of thing where they've just said these are poor schools and these, I think it's the red that are the poor.
Yep.
Anyway, they ended up looking at those zone schools, too, and they found that, I mean, those are the schools that get resources poured into them, and even the kids in those schools weren't performing as well as the kids who had been, you know, lotteried out. So, it's really, really interesting stuff.
No, look, but this goes right back to the Moynihan report from way back when, right? Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, we can't show much of an effect of, you know, spending more money to help poor kids. But, you know, back then there was an effect on the you know, peer effects in terms of who the kids were going to school with. And that still holds up today.
Yes, well, I think one of the other unique things about Montgomery County, though, is that it is so wealthy. I mean, it's one of the wealthiest counties in the United States.
Right.
And so I don't know if this is something that would be replicable across many, many, many counties in the U.S. It's very unique, and, you know, I don't know if it's, I don't know if you could.
Okay, so Amber, what song do we have this week that goes along with the study?
So since we're talking about neighborhoods, we are going to put on our sweater vest and go back to Mr. Rogers' neighborhood.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? It's a neighborly day in this beauty wood, a neighborly day for a beauty. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? I have always wanted to have a neighbor just like you. I've always wanted to live in a neighborhood with you. So let's make the most of this beautiful day. Since we're together, we might as well say, would you be mine? Could you be mine? Won't you be my neighbor? Won't you please? Won't you please? Please, won't you be my neighbor? I'm glad we're together again.
Janie, I love that song.
It always makes me think of the trains. The trains are the best part, where we would go to the little town. And
yes. It was so making me think of the Eddie Murphy skit.
That too.
With the same song. Back in the day when Saturday Night Live, classic. Okay. Well, it is now time for us to rate that reform. Okay, intern Amanda, welcome. Your first time on the show. We're glad to have you here. Which reform are we rating today?
Thank you very much. We're rating a reform in Maine, which is bringing some Chinese students into a school district up there. The star of this week's Rate That Reform story is Ken Smith, superintendent of the Millinocket Schools in Maine. Mr. Smith is going on a trip to China this week with a new kind of mission. He's looking for some Chinese students to bring back to Maine to attend his district's public high school. He's not just interested in cultural diversity or propping up flagging enrollment. He is looking for a fresh revenue stream, as these students will pay close to $30,000 a year to attend his school. In his dream world, Mr. Smith would like to get as many as 200 Chinese students for next year, which would be quite the influx for a school district with 550 kids. But his consulting company is urging him to aim for 20. Either way, that's a hefty benefit for the district. And why, you might wonder, would this be an attractive option for the Chinese kids, especially given the relative mediocrity of the American public education system? Well, apparently it might boost their chances of getting into a U.S. college after high school, and it would certainly give them ample opportunities to practice writing and speaking in English. And plus, you can't beat the natural beauty of northern Maine. This reform gets a B. It deserves due credit for creativity in a tight budget season, but for me, that's tempered by the somewhat questionable motivations and even questionable morality of the whole thing.
Wow. Ooh, bring out the morality card. Ooh, I like it. I like it. On the one hand, it is very entrepreneurial. On the other hand, like, the irony here, I mean, isn't China already propping up our education system enough? I mean, that whole $100 billion bailout was, you know, thanks to China. So
but at least this time we don't owe them money back. They're just giving us money.
I guess so. And by the way, I mean, I'm going to sound a little checker on this one. I mean, aren't we worried that they could be spies? I mean, who knows what's up there in northern Maine that they want to get their hands on?
I mean, I don't think there's like conspiracy theory here, but I think there's some validity to saying, you know, why should our public schools be educating so many students from other countries? There's legitimateness to foreign exchange programs, but to have, you know, he wants to bring in 200 kids, to have an entire school system devoted to educating Chinese students in the U.S. I just don't know if that's really the purpose of public education.
Well, I do hope we follow this story. I want to know how his trip goes. And, it, you know, look,
yeah.
If he gets 20 students, I think that would be kind of neat. I think it's kind of a neat idea. 200.
I think that's where it kind of gets a little out of control.
I mean, I'd like to picture, like, what is prom going to be like if that's the case? I mean, like, if you got 20 kids who don't really know much about American culture, you know, you can assimilate them. You know, if you got 200 kids, I don't know. I think you're just raising some real questions there.
I want to know what it's like when he actually goes over there and just, you know, what's he finding kids on the street and saying, hey, come to America with me. I'll take you to school. I mean,
right. What's his pitch?
Well, yeah, what's his strategy
and
here?
Does he tell them the truth about northern Maine? Which I'm sure is, I never, you know, is a beautiful place filled with moose and other wonderful things of the wildlife.
Beautiful in a picture, maybe.
Outdoor activities.
In the summer, maybe.
All right. Well, that's all the time we've got for the show this week. Thanks for joining. Until next week.
I'm Janie Skull.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.